One of the things that we talk about is the goosebump moment in music. You know, what moment in music gives you the goosebumps? And I'm always curious about whether the same moment would give goosebumps to all the people, or what each person has a different moment in music that gives them the goosebumps. And I think that that's the case. Everybody reacts differently.
That may well be, but it's hard to imagine that anyone who has a heart wouldn't get goosebumps listening to Itzhak Perlman play any music on the violin. That was Perlman you just heard speaking, of course. He is one of the greatest and most beloved violinists of all time. A rock star, you could say, of classical music. Itzhak Perlman is the subject of today's episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Itzhak Perlman was born in Israel in the 1940s, but through a strange twist of fate, he became a television sensation in the United States when he was just 13.
I'll just give you a very quick history about this. Ed Sullivan, in 1958, came to Israel because he wanted to have a show made only of Israeli artists, Israeli acts. Because with Ed Sullivan, you know, Ed Sullivan was a true variety program. So that's why I said acts, because it's like anything went. So he wanted to do it just from Israeli artists. So there were national auditions. Everybody would audition, you know, anybody that did anything, whether musicians or dancers or singers or comedians, whatever it is. And then it was narrowed down to a few, and then he came himself to Israel for the final choosing. And so I was one of the people that were chosen to be on the show.
That was just the first time Itzhak Perlman played his violin on the Ed Sullivan Show. Perlman appeared two more times when he was 13 and three times when he was 18 or 19. One of those shows also featured the Rolling Stones making their Ed Sullivan Show debut. In October of this year, 2017, Itzhak Perlman sat down with the Academy of Achievement to talk about his life in music. The Washington Post's Mary Jordan conducted the interview for the Academy, and she started by asking Perlman about those Ed Sullivan appearances.
How did that show change your life?
Well, that show basically gave me the opportunity to come to the United States. Because at that time, you see, I played the violin nicely. I was talented and played the violin, but people could not didn't really take it very seriously because of my polio, because I had polio when I was four. And so I was sitting down and I was playing, and people always said, well, you know, I don't know if we can have a career, blah, blah, blah. I didn't take it seriously. I would say that, you know, in every little country, you know, after a while, you go abroad to complete your studies. And we have this Hebrew word, says lehishtalmut, which means to complete, a completion. So he was my ticket to the United States, Ed Sullivan.
By the time 13-year-old Itzhak Perlman appeared for the first time on Ed Sullivan, he'd already been playing violin for a decade, ever since he'd heard the legendary violinist Yasha Heifetz coming through the family's radio and told his parents he wanted to sound like that. They tried to get him into a conservatory, but he was too small to hold a violin. His parents bought him a violin anyway, a toy-sized one to start on. Perlman wasn't too happy about the sound it made. After all, it didn't sound anything like Yasha Heifetz's. But he didn't lose his enthusiasm. Eventually, he got lessons and a better violin. And by 1958, Itzhak's destiny seemed written in stone. The family took him to New York to begin the next phase of his musical education.
Very early on, you were here at Juilliard, where we're doing this interview now, and working with Dorothy DeLay.
Right.
And she wrote this about you. You were only a young teenager. I had never seen such fingers on a 13-year-old. The development of skill was so far beyond that of any other child. It was just startling. He had large hands, a fluent arm, exceptional coordination, and superb timing. I could not believe my ears.
I guess she liked it.
How helpful was Dorothy DeLay and your other teachers?
It's very funny because this is the room that she taught in, where we are right now. That's her studio. Let me give you the look. I studied in very, very short history of the way I studied. I studied with one teacher, actually, in Israel. I studied with a teacher who was of Russian background. I studied with her. She's the only one that I studied with. We studied at the age of 5, and she taught me until I was 13, and that's when I came to the States. Her name was Rivka Goldgard, and she was basically a taskmaster. She was very good. She knew certain things, but it was one of those things where you better practice or else. It was one of those things, you know. And if you don't sound good, I'll tell you what to do, and you do it. Then I came to the States, and I studied with Dorothy DeLay and with Ivan Galamian. So at that time, it's very interesting. I heard about Galamian when I was still in Israel. And that when the Ed Sullivan situation arose, that was my way of going to Juilliard and studying with Galamian, because that was the guy. So, but at that time, Dorothy DeLay was his assistant. So she came when I remember I was in the hotel downtown in Manhattan, you know, the first hotel, very, very depressing. You know, it was one of those hotels where you opened the door and you could touch the window. That's how big the room was. And she came in, and I was not very happy because I was missing my father, because I came here only with my mother. And then my father joined us later. And I was missing my friends. I had friends in school and stuff. So I was alone, and I didn't speak the language. So I was not in a great mood. And Ms. DeLay came in, and she said something in English, and I couldn't understand what she was talking about, and I just played. So that was... And then we started... So she was the first one to teach me. And then Galamian joined later, you know, a few months later. So her system was different than anything that I've experienced before. The way that she would teach would be, you would play something and she would ask you what you thought about it. And she would ask you what I think can be done to maybe improve it, or what I think. And I would always hate it, because I wasn't used to it. I was used to people telling me what to do, and I would try and do it. She didn't tell me what to do. She asked me, what should I do? And I would always say to her, just tell me. She would always, you know, my favorite example is when something was out of tune, she would say, "Sugar Plum," you know, she would always call you Sugar Plum, you know, she was from Kansas, you know. She said, "Sugar Plum, what is your concept of G sharp?" That was a code word that it was a little out of tune. And I would always say, "Just tell me what to do is and I'll do it." She wouldn't do that. She would do things to make you think.
How is that helpful to your music?
Well, right now it's very funny because, so after hating it so much, that's the way I teach.
Why?
Because it works better with a student. The student just following orders in some ways is not as imaginative. In other words, the concept, it does not require so much imagination. It does not require a lot of thought. It just inquires following orders. That does not make it your own. If you actually figure out what the problems are, whether it's phrasing, whether it's intonation, whether it's timing, whatever it is, if you can figure it out yourself, then you own it.
They say about you that it's not just amazing talent, it's your imagination that makes you the best in the world. How do you spur imagination, creativity?
How do you teach it, you mean? Look, certain things you cannot teach, and certain things you can. Now, Miss DeLay was very interesting. She believed that you could teach anything. And we would always have a fight about it. We would say, "No, Miss DeLay, no, you can teach this, you can teach this, you can teach that, but you cannot teach a certain gift for, you know, when somebody plays and it moves you. Cannot teach that. Cannot teach that. That's something that, and you don't, you know, and the player, obviously, does not really know what he or she do to make that happen. It's very funny. The other day, it was like a week ago, somebody sent me an email. This guy plays the piano. He's an amateur pianist, but he's very serious. And he said, "How do you make an audience cry?" He says, "I want to know how you produce tears in the listener when you play, because I don't know how to do it, and I want to know what the deal is." And I said to him, "I don't know what it is." I said, "All you have to do is just think about the music and about how you feel about the music, and the rest is up to the audience. If that makes them cry, you know, people can cry in concerts for various reasons. They can cry if what you play brings some sad memory. You can do that. You can cry by a particular effect of harmonies that just makes you cry. So that's one of those things I don't think you can teach. It's something that you're born with."
It's no wonder that Itzhak Perlman was chosen to play the violin solos for Steven Spielberg's film Schindler's List. The depth of emotion he brings to whatever he plays is unparalleled. It may be, as he says, a gift he was born with, but most people born with the gift will never practice enough to realize their potential for greatness. And others, Perlman explains here, will simply lose it.
Oh, yes. Sometimes it has to do with age. You know, you see somebody who is 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, 13-year-old, and it's absolutely incredible. Just like, accomplished, totally, ready for Carnegie Hall. But then comes the big challenge. What happens in the next 5 years, next 6 years? Will you survive your gift? That's important. Sometimes people play and they don't know what they do. It just comes and plays. And one morning they wake up and they said, you know what I'm doing is really, really tough. And then they start thinking about it and it's gone. And I'm telling you, you if you look at YouTube, on the internet, you see so many incredibly talented and gifted players, 8 years old, 9 years old, 10 years old, and you said, oh my God, this does not necessarily mean that they're going to grow up and have a career. Doesn't mean that at all. Look, let's face it, to be a musician is not normal. It's abnormal, you know. If you are, anything that you do as a child that is special, whether it's ice skating, playing tennis, playing the violin, playing the cello, playing the piano, which requires practicing, what's natural about that? You know, that you have to spend, you know, when I was growing up, I spent 3 hours a day practicing. Now, 3 hours a day is not even a lot. Some kids, you know, and I always say to them, don't practice, you know, 5 hours is it. But can you imagine that you have to go to school and practice and do your homework? It's very serious. And sometimes, you know, you have to have a real something inside of you that really wants to do it.
Having polio affected your career?
Having polio did not affect my career as to getting the career. That was a little more difficult. Because I constantly had to prove to people that they should just not look at the fact that I'm sitting, but just listen to me. That was it. It could have had an effect, a negative effect, but my parents were very, they believed in me. That's the thing. They believed in me. It's very easy, you know, when you have a child, you know, with an illness like polio, you can't walk and so on and so forth. It's very easy to be, shall we say, quietly about, oh, he's playing music, that's very nice. But no, they didn't do that. They said, you've got to, you know, they took my music seriously. They took me seriously.
How did they tell you that?
They didn't. They just, they were very strict as far as, especially my mother, you know, you've got to practice. That was basically the whole thing of my childhood, is you got to practice. You know, that's what we always would fight about. We wouldn't fight about anything else. I was pretty good in school, and so on, but you gotta practice. Yasha Heifetz used to say, playing the violin is 10% talent and 90% sweat. Well, you have to really practice.
You do have famously large hands. How did that help you with the violin?
Large hands does not help you with the violin. Large hands helps you with playing the piano, playing the cello, maybe playing the viola, but playing the violin large hands is not a plus. And then sometimes it's a minus because the spaces on the violin are smaller. But I managed.
Can you tell us what it's like to be on the stage, maybe at Carnegie Hall or some other concert? What does it feel like when you move the audience?
I mean, I don't know. All I do is my job. My job is to tell the audience what is my concept of the piece that I'm playing. Listen to what I'm playing, and this is the way I feel about that piece. And that hopefully communicates to the audience. So whenever I play a piece, this is my representation of the piece, and I hope that the audience understands the way I feel about it. That's the way I do it. And that when that has nothing to do whether it's Carnegie Hall or whether it's in a small place, any place. Whenever I play, whether it's a big place or a small town, big town, etc., I have to communicate with the audience.
So after decades of concerts, you've played for Queen Elizabeth, you've played at the inauguration of Barack Obama. Is there any concert that stands out in your mind? Any performance?
Yeah. The Barack Obama one was for me an incredible experience simply because it was so cold. It was so cold. It was just incredible. But it was such a great honor. Being a part of history is something special. You know, I've played many places. I played in Russia before, when it was the Soviet Union, with the Israel Philharmonic. That for me stands out because it was something that didn't occur before. It was like it had a political ramifications and so on, and so that stands out. Playing in the Eastern Bloc countries.
Here's a recording from that performance in 1990 when Itzhak Perlman and the Israeli Philharmonic played in what was still then Soviet Russia.
We're talking about your concerts in the Soviet era. Music was kind of a soft power diplomatic tool then.
Always. And music was a barometer. You know, when it came to Israel and Russia, music was always a barometer. If you were to play, that means that the relationship between the countries was warming up. It's not just Russia, it's other places, you know. And you could always tell, because that was the first sign. Can give concert there. ¶¶
What was the worst performance?
Well, I've had a couple of interesting memory slips that forced me to actually compose to find myself back into the thing. So that was, shall we say, a nice experience, in quotes. And that was really something. And I remember I was playing and all of a sudden I was doing my playing and I heard the conductor clearing his throat in the middle of the performance. And I said to myself, can't he clear his throat quietly? Because it was going, you know, I said, what is he doing? So I kind of looked up and he was going like with a kind of question mark. And then I realized that I actually skipped an entire movement. I started the beginning and I was already at the end. And so I immediately went into defense mode and I just kind of went like that, don't worry about it. And that's when I started to compose a couple of lines to get back to the cadence, so that was it. But you never forget these things, you know.
So you're on stage.
Yeah.
You forgot a whole movement.
Yeah, totally. I just skipped it.
And you don't panic? What do you do?
No, you just say, well, okay, you know, let's see what I'm gonna do, you know. I mean, and I just figured it out.
If you weren't a violinist, what do you think you
probably
would do?
A chef.
Why?
Because I love to eat.
Do you like to cook?
I love to cook. Yes, I love to cook, and I just like the whole process. It's fascinating. It's fascinating, you know. So, look, who knows what I would be? Maybe I would be a ballet dancer. Maybe I would be a tennis player. I don't know. I mean, you know, you get handed what you have, and I probably would have been a musician, because I mean, I can't imagine not being a musician.
Is it really true that you weren't even 3 years old and you could recite arias back from the radio?
Well, yeah, I could. I like, you know, I was I imitated what I heard. Yeah, I imitated what I heard. So that's the thing, is that one of the things that I feel that I'm very lucky, two things actually, maybe a few more. First of all, I'm lucky that I make a living at something that I love, which is actually should be the goal of everybody. The goal of everybody is to make, if you can make a living with something that you really adore, what better things can happen if you can do that? That's one thing. The other thing is that I'm actually able to cry when I hear certain kinds of music. And I think that's amazing that I'm affected by that, you know. And it's something, it's me, you know. So if I hear something on the radio and I say, oh, my God.
Tell me a piece of music that might make you cry.
A recording that I think is me and I hate it? Oh, I'll cry. Did I record this? You know, sometimes I listen on the radio and I hear a violinist playing and I said, oh my God, I hope it's not me. Because if it's me, oh, I wouldn't do it like that today. Or you can say, it better be me because it's too good. What makes me cry? The opening of Mozart's Requiem. That is just like, forget about it. And it's not like, it's not a tearjerker. It's just, it moves you. It moves you in a certain way. Anything that, you know, I remember my first experiences, I suppose, that made me cry is chamber music by Brahms. And, you know, and people ask why, and I can't understand. You know, it must be, I think that if you want to really be specific and you want to be really accurate, is what it is scientific about it. It's probably a thing about harmonies, that the harmonies affect you in a certain way. It's a harmonic reaction. You know, like when you listen, for example, to Puccini, you know, like Bohème, you know, and that's kind of automatic. they almost call it musical pornography, because it makes you, oh my God, you know. So, but what is that really? It's basically really the way the composer put the harmonies together, and I think that has an effect.
What you're hearing is Itzhak Perlman's recording with Daniel Barenboim of Brahms' Violin Sonata No. 1 in G major, Opus 78.
A harmony is a painting. And then when you play something and the phrase is a very special phrase, I always tell my students, I said, it's not like, you know, you go to a museum and you see a painting that's nice, 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 nice. Then you see the Mona Lisa and you just say, nice, 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 and you just go away. And you say, no, if there's a special harmony, like a great harmony, you have to say, that's something special, and you have to show that in the way you phrase. So you have to tell the audience, I am aware that this is a special moment in this piece. If you are aware of that, everybody will be aware of it. But if you just go, like you pass by a great work of art and you just go, oh, nice, 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 then nobody's going to be aware of that.
Is there a piece of music that you've played more than any other?
Probably, but I wouldn't know. I mean, I would probably say any of the big violin concertos, you know, Beethoven, Brahms, Tchaikovsky, and so on. Those are the ones that people want all the time. So,
Still get emotionally involved in these pieces after thousands of times?
Well, that's a very good question, and that's one of the great challenges for a performing musician, and that's what I talk about to my students. I always say to them, you know, it's very easy to play a piece for the first time because you're excited, you know, you're a little nervous, you get inspired. Then the second time comes and you feel a little better about it because you know that you can do it. And then the third time, it may be, how do I play that piece? Well, I played that piece like yesterday. And then the fourth time, who knows? And then after a while, the danger is to play the piece the way it goes. And that's where the mistake is. You know, I mean, there's no such thing as the way it goes. You know, you don't play a piece the way it goes. You play a piece the way it is. And the way it goes is danger, because then as a result, what happens is you imitate what you do, and it loses the spontaneity. So the way I deal with that is I basically always, always listen to the music rather than just saying, well, you know, I play this phrase this way and that's the way I play it. That's not necessarily the case. You know, I may play the phrase slightly differently. And again, it's not a question of today I'm playing loud, tomorrow I'm playing soft. It's not like that. It's very subtle. And I always call it, you know, it's our kind of improvisation. Because when people play jazz, they improvise. But when they improvise, they really improvise. They play different notes. They play different harmonies. And they do certain things. And if you hear a piece one time, you hear the same piece the second time, it's really different. With classical musicians, the improvisation is very subtle. You know, you hear it the first time, it's like this. You hear it the second time, it has maybe a freshness. And that's a little bit of an improvisation, but it's very subtle. It's about timing, it's about phrasing, it's about color, but it's not about necessarily, it's not about notes. The notes are the same. So in many ways, to improvise that way in classical music is very difficult.
What is the color of music?
Color. Well, color has to do with a lot of things. Again, people with talent know how to do color. Now, if you want me to talk to you about the technical aspect of color, it has to do with bow pressure. It has to do with bow speed. It has to do with the amount of vibrato that you use in the left hand. It has to do with, do you use more vibrato, do you use less vibrato? What's the combination? When people are inspired, they use color. And of course, color is a talent. Do you teach, can you teach that? I don't think so. You can say, well, here you should play softer, here you should play more, here you should do. But when it comes to naturally doing something, that's a talent. And I always mention to my students, I always said, I don't want to know what you're doing. In other words, the minute I know what you're doing, then it's not spontaneous. You know, like say, oh, here they're going to slow down here, they're going to play softer here, they're going to play out. It becomes an affect. I want you to be a magician. Not musician, a magician. What does a magician do? It does something that's sleight of hand and you see it. It's the same thing with music, you know. You have to be a magician so that when the listener listens, the listener says, oh my God, this is so amazing. Rather than saying, well, I like the way he did this and I like the way he did that. That's no longer spontaneous. I just want to relax, you know. Of course, as a teacher, if somebody asks me what made it so good, I can kind of go into it under a magnifying glass and say, well, you know, it was this way, it was that way. But as a listener, I just want to say, oh, that was so fresh. That was so nice. I just loved it. And I don't want to ask any questions. And that's a talent.
With almost 70 years of playing under his belt, more than 100 recordings, and who knows how many thousands of performances, Itzhak Perlman says that he still needs to practice.
I do at least 20 minutes a day. That's good if I do it. You know, for me, the practicing is not so much how much you practice, it's the how often. At my age, it's how often. You know, if I do something every day, that's good. Rather than do a couple of hours one day and then not do anything for 3 or 4 days, that's bad. So if you do it every day, your hands are familiar.
You have a lot of performances and a lot of music ahead of you. But at the end of your career, what do you hope your contribution to music is?
God, I'm not thinking about what my effect would be. I don't think about it. I'm being very selfish. I think about how am I going to continue to have a good time in music and to be still inspired by music. And as long as I can do that, then my goal is accomplished. After all of these years, yes, if I am not bored by the Beethoven Violin Concerto, I'm in good shape.
The incomparable Itzhak Perlman, violinist, conductor, and teacher. He's won 15 Grammy Awards for his recordings and one for lifetime achievement. He is a Kennedy Center honoree, a winner of the National Medal of Arts, and a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Mr. Perlman spoke with Mary Jordan for the Academy of Achievement in October of 2017. He continues to tour the country and the world and run the Perlman Music Program for Young String Players, which he founded with his wife, Toby.
Is it really true that your wife-to-be heard you play, walked up to you and said, I'm going to marry you?
No, she didn't say, I'm going to marry you. She said, will you marry me? And yeah, it's true. It's totally true. I was flabbergasted. Oh, look, I was 17. You know, it's kind of, you know, like that. You know, that's how we met. It's a true story.
I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. What It Takes is funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thank you.